A break in the win streak.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Stocks are down about 20 minutes into trading. Let's check the markets. Dow is down more than a percent at this hour, 76 points. NASDAQ down about a quarter of a percent. The S&P 500 down about 0.75%. European shares have turned lower for the most part. In Asia, Hong Kong shares rose nearly 2%. More modest gains in Japan, though. The Nikkei added about 0.3%. One of the most active stocks on the NASDAQ this morning is Sun Microsystems. Shares are up more than 65% so far on news of a possible high-tech hookup with IBM. The Wall Street Journal today reports both companies are looking at a merger. Marketplace's Janet Babin joins us now from North Carolina Public Radio. Janet, why does this deal make sense?
Well, Sun Microsystems and IBM share a lot of common ground. They both kind of fought against the ubiquity of Microsoft Windows. They both offer products that don't use Windows. And they both back open source software like Linux. And meanwhile, Sun has been struggling since really the dot-com bust of the early 2000s. In November, it announced that it was going to lay off 6,000 workers, and the company's been shopping around for a partner. The Wall Street Journal actually reports that it talked to Hewlett-Packard, but HP wasn't interested, and they turned Sun down.
Why now, Janet? Why would IBM consider this now?
Aha. Well, there was an announcement this week that Cisco Systems will start selling servers. Now, Cisco is best known for its networks. And in the past, IBM has actually helped Cisco to sell its network equipment to IBM customers. But now that Cisco has started selling servers, that puts Cisco in direct competition with IBM. Meanwhile, Sun Microsystems has servers, and it's got a lot of hardware. So that would help IBM to better compete with Cisco for servers and Hewlett-Packard in the computer hardware department.
So is this deal viable? Is this really going to happen?
Well, at this point, it's a preliminary deal. Neither IBM nor Sun Microsystems is saying anything publicly yet about the deal. And of course, in this economic climate, all deals are suspect until they're down on paper.
All right. Marketplace's Janet Babin. Janet, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The outrage continues over the AIG bailout bonuses. There's a hearing today on Capitol Hill where the company's chairman, Edward Liddy, is set to testify. He's likely to face some serious scorn from lawmakers. Commentator Robert Reich says there are other more troubling aspects to this story.
The real scandal of AIG, recipient of $170 billion taxpayer dollars so far, isn't just that the firm plans to give giant bonuses to its executives. It's that even though the public now owns 80% of AIG, Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, didn't even know of this bonus plan until last week and seems helpless to stop it, despite the fact that the plan runs directly counter to administration promises that taxpayer money will no longer be used for Wall Street bonuses. We've also learned that much of the $170 billion has been used by AIG to pay off counterparties, such as Goldman Sachs. In fact, the original plan to bail out AIG was concocted at a meeting last fall run by former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, who had been a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, along with the current CEO of Goldman Sachs, and the then head of the New York Fed, our current Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Now, none of this would be nearly as awful if the Wall Street bailout were working. But here we are, 6 months after it began, and it's still the case that almost no loans are being made to Main Street. This week, the Fed is launching its own program to get loans to consumers, financed by private investors and bypassing Wall Street. The Wall Street bailout is starting to look like the most expensive tax-supported fiasco in history. And yet it's close to the center of the president's economic recovery program. The public was willing to go along with a large stimulus package, but it won't go along with a second stimulus, and certainly not another bank bailout. And until the public feels confident that taxpayer money is not being thrown down a rat hole, it may balk at other ambitious undertakings, such as healthcare or education or the environment. So before it can clean up Wall Street or do much of anything else, the administration has to clean up the way it's trying to clean up Wall Street.
Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. And you can share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org. You're listening to The Morning Report on Wednesday, March 18th, 2009, at marketplace.org. It is a sign that protectionism is on the rise. Regulators in China have put the kibosh on Coca-Cola's plans to buy a Chinese drink company for a couple billion dollars. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The deal would have hurt competition and limited consumer choice. That was the view of the Ministry of Commerce in Beijing today. Coca-Cola has made a big push into China's juice market. It's growing faster than its soda market. And the Chinese firm it wanted to buy is dominant, too. It has 46% of the pure juice sector. Lots of Chinese may be celebrating this rejection. Polls showed the deal highly unpopular, the idea that a Chinese brand would sell out to foreigners instead of build its own empire. David Wolf advises multinationals in Beijing.
They want to create national champions. They want to build brands that are powerful in China, and once they're powerful in China, turn them loose on the world. Maybe not on the U.S. tomorrow, but on the developing world, Africa, places like that.
And for China, now's the time to catch up to the big boys while they're in recession. If protectionism won here, it wouldn't be new. American lawmakers howled when companies from Dubai and China wanted to acquire U.S. firms. And global economists fear that foreign investment walls are going up in general. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A delegation of 35 Chinese businesses is meeting in London this week to talk about setting up shop in the British capital. London is worried the economic crisis could hinder its reputation as a global business center. Christopher Worth reports.
London's commercial property has become much more affordable, and there are a lot of highly qualified people desperate to find work, two factors that have become selling points. Jeff Wu of the Beijing-based Vance Info Technologies, a member of the delegation, says London is a good starting point for breaking into the European market.
The many technology firms based in Europe has been our customers and could be our potential customers in the future as well.
Wu's company will base their European headquarters in the British capital now that the city is offering free office space for a year and access to advisors to help sort out the details of doing business abroad. Mark Davies, who is hosting the delegation, says Chinese investors are in a better position than most.
They're coming from a home market, which of all the world's economies is probably the one still with growth potential.
London already receives more investment from China than any other European city. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Starbucks has been cutting its business to the bone. It shed jobs and started offering meal deals and instant coffee. Well, its shareholders meet today in Seattle, and one question they'll be asking is, how will making Starbucks look more like McDonald's affect the company's future? Amanda Aronchik reports.
You'd think in a recession that anything you do to attract customers would be a good thing. Matt Langley is the founder of Basis, a brand consultancy company. He says that's true, but only up to a point.
What Starbucks shouldn't be doing, or really any company shouldn't be doing, is taking their own brand and devaluing it, and making their brand seem that it's now cheap and kind of a little tarnished.
Langley calls it brand dilution. That's when customers come expecting a certain something, but find something else. He says people go to Starbucks for the experience, a personalized cup of coffee made to order. It's not supposed to be a value meal. Nick O'Flaherty works for Wolf Olins, a branding company. He says there's a real danger in going too cheap.
Next thing, you know, Starbucks is down at the same sort of level as Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's.
O'Flaherty says once companies downgrade from premium, it's difficult for them to step back up. The acid test for Starbucks. Will customers still be willing to pay $4 for a latte? When the recession ends, that is, and when it comes without the oatmeal. I'm Amanda Aronchik for Marketplace.
Tonight, American Idol announces its final 10. They get to go on tour with the show for a year. A thumbs up from Simon Cowell may be the most famous way to launch your career in pop music. But it's not the only one. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
Ah, the Supremes' Baby Love.
Baby love, my baby.
The man who wrote that and 53 more number one hits is Lamont Dozier, a Motown legend. So what was his training?
Oh, God, none at all. No classical training. I've been self-taught.
Dozier took lessons in the school of life. He eavesdropped at his grandma's beauty shop.
And I hear one of the girls, and she's heartbroken about some guy come to find out he was a cad. I would write down these little ideas. And they're true-to-life stories.
Pay attention.
That's advice Professor Lamont Dozier might give a songwriting class this fall at the University of Southern California. It's the first university to offer a bachelor's degree in popular music performance.
Many schools have played around with this, but been afraid to really call it what it is, American popular music.
That's Robert Cudieta, dean of USC's Thornton School of Music. He says it's time pop joined the canon. It's a big part of music and the music market. After all, there's not much demand for a concert bassoonist.
You'd be better off running for the U.S. Senate, because at least there's 100 of those jobs.
And students, spending more than $30,000 a year for tuition, can study the music that interests them.
We can approach it with the same discipline, the same rigor, as somebody studying a classical instrument.
That's USC Associate Dean Chris Sampson. His BA is in classical guitar, but he's really a rock drummer. The 20 students in the pop program Sampson helped design will study music, but they'll also learn to book tours, read contracts, and market their work.
That's the nature of the profession. It's fundamentally entrepreneurial.
17-year-old James Gallup auditioned for USC this year.
Little world, slip through my hand.
He's an ambitious singer-songwriter, but wants more options than music.
At a school like this, you can get all of your academic needs as well as your musical needs.
If he doesn't get into the popular music program, Gallup says he'll study English. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
U.S. mortgage applications shot up last week. The Mortgage Bankers Association says the numbers were driven mostly by refinancing. The average rate for a 30-year mortgage fell to 4.89%. The U.S. Federal Reserve Board will announce today what it plans to do, or not, with already bare-bones rates here at home. And in Phoenix today, community bankers are kicking off their annual convention. Sponsors are promising new ideas to help small banks deal not only with tough economic times, tough fallout, but costly new regulations. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
For the most part, the nation's smaller banks steered clear the complicated and risky kind of loan making that proved to be the downfall of their giant rivals, but they're still feeling the sting.
I didn't do it, it's not my problem, and yet I'm paying for it.
Affinity Bank CEO Michael McGuire says that's how many of his fellow community bankers feel these days. He runs a small banking chain in Ventura, California, north of L.A., and he's concerned over the higher levels of cash the government is pressuring all banks to raise now. He says that's hurting their ability to lend. At the same time, community banks could play a key role in restoring confidence at the local level.
If the consumer sees healthy businesses on Main Street, I think the consumer is more likely to get out and spend and be a part of the recovering economy.
Times are even tougher for smaller community banks with maybe one or two branches. Bart Narter with the research firm Celent says they can't afford the growing expense of tighter government regulations and providing costly high-tech services such as online banking.
The increased complexity is raising the bar as to the minimum viable size of a bank.
Seems these days some banks are too big to fail and some too small to survive. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Once again, stocks are down more than a percent for the Dow and S&P. The latest numbers at our website, marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.